All right, let's dive into another one of these Supreme Court cases. Picture this. You're at a public university. Tons of student life. There's a debate club and drama club, even a socialist alliance.
Oh, yeah.
All funded by the university, like through student fees and stuff.
Mm.
But then a Christian fellowship wants to publish a magazine, and the university's like, whoa, hold on. We don't fund religious activities. Do you think that's fair?
Well, you're getting right to the heart of Rosenberger v. University of Virginia, a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court back in 1995. It really forces us to think about the balance between freedom of speech and the separation of church and state. Two big, big ideas in the Constitution.
Yeah, two of the biggest, probably. Okay, so let's set the scene. We're at the University of Virginia, and they have this thing called the Student Activities Fund. We'll call it the SAF for short.
Yeah.
It's funded by student fees, so everyone chips in.
Right. And the goal is to kind of support a wide range of student groups and activities, just try to make campus life more vibrant, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Different voices and all that.
Totally. So into this mix walks Wide Awake Productions. We'll call them WAP for short.
Okay.
It's a student group led by Ronald Rosenberger. And they published this Christian magazine called, you guessed it, Wide Awake. They applied for SAF funding to cover, you know, their printing costs. But the university said no.
Yeah, they actually had this rule that said they wouldn't fund anything they defined as religious activities. And their definition of religious activities was quite broad. Anything promoting or manifesting a belief in a deity or an ultimate reality.
So even like, let's say a publication with a Christian perspective, but on something like philosophy or even politics, could be considered off limits. I mean, that seems like that would shut down a lot of different viewpoints.
Exactly. And that's why Rosenberger felt like he was being discriminated against, you know, based on his beliefs. So he decided to take the university to court.
Right on.
He claimed that his First Amendment rights were being violated.
Okay, so off to court they go. First stop, the district court. And they sided with the university. But then the case goes up on appeal to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and things get a little messy.
Yeah. So the Fourth Circuit, they kind of acknowledge that this looked like content discrimination, which is generally a big no-no when it comes to free speech.
Yeah.
But ultimately, they upheld the lower court's decision. They argued that the university had had a real interest in maintaining the separation between church and state.
So they're basically saying, well, sometimes you have to restrict certain types of speech to protect these other values.
Right.
High-stakes stuff. So it keeps going up the legal ladder, and it lands on the doorstep of the Supreme Court.
With this split decision.
Yeah, a real showdown.
Mm-hmm.
So the Supreme Court had to grapple with these two big questions. First, did the university's refusal to fund WAP actually violate the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech? Like, more specifically, did this qualify as viewpoint discrimination? Because, as we know, in the legal world, viewpoint discrimination is just, like, it's like public enemy number one when it comes to free speech. It's not just shutting down a particular topic, but it's shutting down specific viewpoints on that topic.
Exactly. It would be like if they funded a magazine that was, let's say, arguing for gun control, but then refused to fund one that was arguing against it.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that. And the second question was, did funding WAP violate the Establishment Clause? That part of the First Amendment that prohibits the government from establishing a religion, essentially it was the university endorsing religion by giving WAP money.
So they're stuck between this rock and a hard place, trying to protect free speech, but then also, you know, not trip over this separation of church and state. What'd they decide?
5-4 decision. So it was a close one.
Oh, wow.
The majority ultimately sided with Rosenberger and said that the Student Activities Fund, the SAF, was basically a limited public forum.
Okay, hold on. Break that down for us. What's a limited public forum?
So think of it like a public park that allows protests but has rules against, you know, noise after a certain hour.
Right.
Or a university auditorium that's open to all student groups for events, but, you know, maybe they have restrictions on certain types of activities that are allowed there. It's open for expression, but it has some limitations. So the court basically said, once you open up a program like this to student groups, you can't pick and choose which ones get funding based on their ideology.
So you're saying the same principle that applies to that public park or that auditorium also applies to student funding. Like, you can set some ground rules, but you can't discriminate against certain groups just because you don't like their message.
Right. The court said that the university's actions amounted to viewpoint discrimination, and that's unconstitutional.
But what about the argument that funding a Christian magazine is somehow different from funding, like, I don't know, a chess club or a hiking group? Like, what did the court say about the whole Establishment Clause issue?
Well, they addressed that directly. They pointed out that the SEF was neutral toward religion. I mean, it funded all sorts of groups, not just religious ones. Plus, they made this distinction, like, this was about the government funding private speech, not the government speaking itself.
Okay, so it's like the university is providing a platform or a megaphone, but they're not actually dictating what's being said through that megaphone.
Right, exactly. They actually used this analogy. They said the SF was like a pizza fund for student groups. And if the vegans get a slice, you can't exclude the vegetarians just because they eat cheese. You're not endorsing vegetarianism by letting them get pizza. You're just being neutral and letting everyone participate.
I love that. That's such a good analogy. So it really drives home that idea of government neutrality. But, you know, isn't religion different in some ways? I mean, what about groups that promote beliefs that most people might find, you know, offensive or even harmful? Does the university have to fund them too?
Oh, that's a really important question. And it gets to the heart of some of the dissenting opinions in this case. We should definitely talk about those.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Some people might find that idea kind of unsettling. And that's exactly the concern that Justice Souter had. He wrote one of the dissenting opinions. He argued that directly funding a religious publication, no matter how neutral the program is supposed to be, still crosses the line. It's basically unconstitutional support of religion.
So he's saying, hold on, money talks. Like, even if the university claims to be neutral, giving funds to a religious group implies a certain level of endorsement.
Exactly. Justice Souter really felt that separation should be maintained very strictly, even in this kind of context where you have this neutral funding program. He worried about this creating a slippery slope where more and more public funds could end up going towards religious activities.
That's a good point. It raises the question, where do you draw the line? If the university can fund a Christian magazine, can they also fund a mosque or a temple? What about a group that promotes, I don't know, Scientology or Satanism? Yeah, and those are the kinds of questions that make this case so complex and interesting. It's not just black and white. Even within the majority, there were different views on how to apply these principles. Justice O'Connor, for example, she wrote a concurring opinion where she emphasized looking at these situations on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. So she's basically saying, let's not jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
We need to carefully examine the specifics of each case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the nature of the funding program, the type of speech, all that stuff.
Right. She was concerned about setting a precedent that could be applied too broadly and maybe lead to outcomes that could actually undermine the separation of church and state. And then you had Justice Thomas, who brought in some really interesting historical arguments.
Ooh, I love when history comes into play. What did he have to say?
Well, he argued that historically religious groups have always participated in government programs and that excluding them might actually be a departure from the norm. He pointed to examples from early American history where religious institutions actually received public funding or played a role in civic life.
So he's essentially saying, hey, look, this isn't some radical new idea. Religious groups have always been part of American society. There's no reason to treat them differently now.
Exactly. He was pushing back against this whole idea that there has to be this strict separation between church and state. He argued that, you know, some level of interaction and cooperation has always been kind of the norm.
It's so fascinating how a single case can have so many viewpoints and interpretations, even among the justices themselves. It really shows you how complex these constitutional issues are.
Yeah, absolutely. And that complexity is something we're still dealing with today. I mean, Rosenberger didn't solve all the questions about free speech, religious freedom, and government funding. It gave us a framework and some principles, but applying them can be really tricky.
So what does all this mean for us today, almost 30 years after Rosenberger? Why should our listeners care about this case?
Well, this case is a cornerstone of how universities and really any public institution has to handle funding for student groups. They can't discriminate based on viewpoint, even when that viewpoint is religious. So a Muslim student group that wants to host a speaker, a conservative publication that's printing their own magazine, even a group of Satanists wanting to hold a meeting, they all have to be treated equally under the law.
So the university can't just say, we like these ideas, but we don't like those ideas, so we're only going to fund the groups we agree with.
Exactly. Viewpoint discrimination is a no-go, and this case made that very clear. But of course, it's not always simple. There are gray areas and nuances that make these cases challenging.
Like what? Give us an example.
Okay, what if a group is promoting something illegal or harmful? Does the university have to fund them?
Right. Good point. What if you have a group that advocates for violence or discrimination against a certain group of people?
That's when it gets tricky. The university does have a responsibility to make sure the activities they're funding are legal and don't incite violence or discrimination. But those restrictions have to be content neutral.
So you could have a rule against funding groups that promote violence, but you couldn't have a rule against funding groups that promote a particular religious viewpoint on violence.
Yeah, that's the idea. The focus should be on the action or behavior, not the belief system behind it. But making that distinction isn't always easy, and that's usually where legal challenges come up.
So Rosenberger established this crucial principle of viewpoint neutrality when it comes to funding student groups. But it also created all these new questions and challenges.
Exactly. And those challenges are still being worked out in courts across the country. We see cases about religious groups wanting to restrict their membership based on sexual orientation or beliefs, which can clash with university non-discrimination policies. There are also debates about whether religious groups should be allowed to use campus facilities for worship or other activities that might be seen as proselytizing.
Even though Rosenberger set this precedent, the way it's applied is still being debated. It's like a never-ending legal puzzle.
It really is. And it makes us think about some fundamental questions about free speech, the role of religion in public life, and the limits of government in religious expression.
It sounds like Rosenberger was a really important case, but it didn't provide all the answers. It just showed how complex these issues are and started more debates about balancing different rights and values.
I think that's a great way to put it. Rosenberger was a big moment in this conversation, but just one chapter in a much larger story.
Yeah, it really makes you think, where do we go from here? Does Rosenberger ultimately protect religious liberty, or does it just blur the lines between church and state way too much?
It's tough, right? There's some really good points on both sides.
Yeah. So, like, walk us through the arguments. What are the best points in favor of Rosenberger's impact on religious liberty?
Okay, so you can argue that Rosenberger makes sure religious groups have just as much opportunity as anyone to participate in public life and get their views out there. They're not being shut down just because of their religious beliefs. They've got the same rights, same opportunities as any other student group. And that's a pretty basic part of religious liberty, how it's understood in the U.S.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it kind of levels the playing field a little bit. But what about, like, those concerns about the church and state thing, you know? How do people who are for Rosenberger address that?
They say that the government isn't actually endorsing any one religion just by providing this neutral funding. They're just making a space for diverse voices to be heard, including religious ones. And they really stress that the government isn't controlling the message. They're just giving a platform for that speech to happen.
So it's kind of like the government can give money to, I don't know, like a public park where people can express themselves freely, but it doesn't mean they're endorsing everything that's being said in that park.
Yeah. Exactly. The park is that neutral space, and the government's role is to keep it open and accessible to everyone.
Okay, that makes sense. But let's look at the other side. What are the strongest arguments against Rosenberger? The one saying it actually weakens that separation between church and state.
People against it say that even if a program is neutral on paper, the fact that taxpayer money is supporting religious stuff is a problem, no matter what. They worry it'll become this slippery slope where the government just gets more and more involved with religion.
So even that indirect funding, they're saying that could be seen as the government backing religion.
Exactly. They say it goes against the whole idea of the Establishment Clause, you know, the part that's supposed to stop the government from playing favorites with religions or promoting religion over non-religion. They see Rosenberger as this risky move that could chip away at that separation.
It sounds like the heart of this debate is really just about different ways of understanding the Establishment Clause. Like, how strictly should it be used?
Yeah, you got it. There's no clear-cut answer. It's complicated. People feel strongly about it on both sides.
So where does that leave us? Seems like Rosenberger, while a landmark case, just made this debate about religion and the state even more heated.
It's true. Rosenberger definitely changed things legally and gave some important rules, but it doesn't settle those bigger philosophical questions about religion's place in public life and how much the government can get involved. Those are still up for debate, still ending up in court. We'll probably be dealing with them for a long time.
Well, I think our listeners have a lot to think about after today. It's crazy how a case from almost 30 years ago can still cause such a lively, in-depth discussion.
Yeah, it just shows how powerful these constitutional questions are and how much they affect us even now. They force us to really consider these basic things: free speech, religious freedom, and what role the government should have in a society with so many different beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes these deep dives so cool. We get to explore these tricky topics, hear all the different sides, and hopefully come away with a better grasp of the legal and philosophical stuff that shapes our world.
I agree. It's been great breaking down this case with you. I'm sure we'll have plenty more twists and turns in the legal world to uncover.
For sure. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp, and always remember, the law is constantly evolving. Every new case, every new interpretation keeps things moving.